This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 10th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 161st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we've got the blunderbuss out again and we're going to fill the barrel with boundless cultural treats and shoot them right at you. Watch out. We'll hear from a familiar voice as Andrew Muller talks us through his memoir of a life lived toiling at the coalface of music writing.
It's sort of a memoir of that period and a lament for those magazines and that way of life, and also implicitly a great big gloating hoot that I got to have my fun, but it's too late for everybody else.
We'll be in Copenhagen to inspect the quality, it's normally very high, of their world-renowned documentary festival.
We've really taken in a whole lot of different films that were on the verge of documentary and fiction. And that trend has been enormously popular for the last 5 years.
And we'll rummage around in the special effects cupboard as we profile the pioneering women that worked for the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop and changed the sound of TV and radio forever.
Daphne Oram, at the time, was very unknown. In fact, now when I talk to my composer friends, they know everything about composing and electronic music, but they do not know her still.
Plus, we'll look back at the fall of the Berlin Wall by celebrating the publication of an amazing book, Berlin Wonderland, and we'll groove on with a warm-hearted session of cool electronica from US synth soul wonders, How to Dress Well. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First of all, a song from this week's Midori House session, How to Dress Well, a.k.a. Tom Krell, who flew in from the US for his European tour and kicked things off where else at Midori House. Here are How to Dress Well with Repeat Pleasure.
Now that I loved you, yeah, you know that I wanted all the time. I say there's no home above you, girl, but now there's a new place above that line. Truth can never come without your smile. But life should have warned you, girl, that a limit known as our limit left behind. In an innocent side, wanted all of this to never subside. Never wanna miss a moment of life without your nectar kiss on stone to the night. And now I know all you wanted was to want it more, baby. Something not changing.
That was Repeat Pleasure by How to Dress. Well, more from those guys later on. You'll know our next guest if you've read much of the last 8 years of Monocle magazine or heard much else of Monocle 24. But before gracing Midori House with his incisive words and Australian vows, Andrew Muller was a rock writer for the great British music weekly Melody Maker, one of two British music magazines that bestrode the journalistic firmament like two dueling colossi, for that other title was arch rival the NME. Muller's memoir of his coming of age as a rock hack, from a Sydney free sheet in his native Australia to the hallowed turf of the 26th floor of IPC Publishing's Kingsreach Tower in London, is a self-styled story of misadventures in rock and roll, but also a wise and witty comment on the demise of the music press as the internet consumed all before it like a dark-hearted Pac-Man. I give you the contrarian rockumentarian Andrew Muller.
You'd be walking on broken glass for me. You'd do a noble script after your birthday suit if it please.
It's a music journalism memoir up to a point. It covers the period late 80s when I started writing for the Sydney Street Press to mid-90s when I got sacked for the second and final time by the British Weekly Rock Press. But the point of the book, to the exceedingly limited extent that it has one, is that that turned out to be a very good time to get fired for the second and what turned out to be final time by the British Rock Press, because the Weekly Rock Press started declining more or less at that instant, not necessarily because I was no longer writing for it. The internet may have had slightly more to do with it.
It sort of curled up like a sort of woodlouse. And so went, without Muller, we're nothing.
No, unfortunately, that pleasant though it would be to think that, no, basically what happened was that around that point somebody switched on the World Wide Web and ruined everything for everybody. It's sort of a memoir of that period and a lament for those magazines and that way of life, and also implicitly a great big gloating hoot that I got to have my fun, but it's too late for everybody else.
Too right. We're going to play some songs during this interview as well. What would be the soundtrack to the swan song of your Melody Maker years, I wonder?
I'm just trying to think what, I mean, many artists are mentioned in the book with who I interviewed or toured with or interacted with in some ways. I guess I'm trying to think of the significant ones. I won't name the first act I ever interviewed because nobody's ever heard of them. But the first big international act I did interviewed, and the first time I actually had to do the kind of meeting one's heroes thing, was, I think it was literally the third interview I ever did, which was with Roddy Frame from Aztec Camera, who was in Sydney at the time, and indeed who was in these very studios only a few weeks ago, being interviewed by me yet again, hopefully more coherently than he was 25 years ago.
But somewhere in my heart there is a star that shines for you. Silver splits the blue. Love will see you through. And somewhere in my heart there is the will to set you free.
We'll take it back now then to growing up in Sydney with that your house with the great view, military dad, and having this sort of, I presume it was like a sort of commissioned house with this amazing view over Sydney Harbour, which you didn't necessarily want to leave, but you did want to not be at school, presumably. And you started working for a free music weekly called On The Street.
I did.
This is sort of where it all kind of picked off. And it kicked off with sort of sending in a spec review of a band, a local band doing a local sort of gig. And it sort of grew from there. Nobody really advertises for jobs as a music writer, as a rock journalist. You obviously found this, like most people that end up doing that profession, you found out by sending a letter in, presumably.
Well, the thing is, people do now advertise for jobs for rock journalists. It just always says about four paragraphs down, we're not actually going to pay you or anything. Right. Yeah, that actually, it might be another good musical choice. That first artist I ever reviewed ever was Ed Cooper and The Yard Goes On Forever. Ed Cooper, ex of The Saints and Laughing Clowns, currently of Nick Cave and The Bad Seeds. But literally, yeah, that was what happened. I wrote some things about what I thought about this show at the Mossman Hotel and mailed it into On The Street, and they printed it to my still inexpressible delight and to my yet more inexpressible delight, then rang me up and said, we would like to give you money for that. And that was how I started writing for Melody Maker as well. I sent them reviews of shows from Sydney.
Don't want you on the music.
So we're coming to the sort of like hot crucible of the early 90s, I guess. When you were in the UK, you were working on Star for Melody Maker, and this is where grunge and Nirvana sort of turned into Britpop and all the rest of it. This was a point at which it was exceptionally important what was cool, presumably, but also what was in the charts was also quite good. Maybe.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, you know, it's that standard old person's lament that, you know, doesn't anyone remember when good music was popular and popular music was good? But there did seem to be a period in the mid-90s, both early to mid-90s, largely due to grunge and then the Britpop response to it, where that was the case. And it was a very strange time to be a writer on the Weekly Music Press, because all of a sudden all these bands that nobody but us had ever cared about suddenly became the biggest bands in the country. The same bands that were being written about in Melody Maker were being written about in The Sun and The Times. It was quite strange. But it did turn out, not that we saw it coming at the time, but for various reasons, it turned out really to be something of a final hurrah for the music press as it then was. It was excellent fun.
Suede were my favourite band from that period.
They were fantastic, of the
sort of big four British bands, if you like. They were the sort of precursors. I think they had an Enemy front cover before they even put out a single.
It was a Melody Maker front cover before they've ever put it out. And it was you. It wasn't me. I mentioned this in the book. My one contribution to that, because
Andrew's just scratched a hole.
Yeah, totally. No, we decided to take a flyer on Suede because we got this demo tape, which we just loved. We'd been to see them live. It's often forgotten about Suede. They were a fantastic live band. They were so good. So we decided to put them on the cover. Steve Sutherland, the then editor, then deputy editor rather, I think it was his idea to write the headline, "The Best New Band in Britain?" At which point I put my hand up, reminding everybody of that rarely fallible rule which holds that if the newspaper headline ends in a question mark, the answer is no. So I said, look, if we're going to do this, let's do this. Let's just call them the best new band in Britain, which obviously ended up becoming a massive, massive albatross for poor old Suede. But they did totally kind of prove us right.
Ask you a little bit about heroes and villains. They're both in the book and they're on both sort of sides of the divide, because you seem to idolise the music writers, the staff writers and the editors, the Melody Maker, as much as the musicians sometimes. Turning up to that office must have been more, I guess, nerve-wracking than interviewing any of the sort of megastars or people that you particularly loved as artists.
It is a moment that I do actually recall with quite toe-curling clarity, sort of the nervousness as the lift extended 25 floors or 26 floors of Kingsreach Tower, and then walking down that corridor and walking into the office. I mean, they knew I was coming because I'd been writing for Melody Maker from Sydney for some time, but still it was, all of a sudden these people who I felt I really had got to know, because Melody Maker, whether deliberately or not, operated a fairly laissez-faire editorial hand, it's fair to say. People were encouraged to indulge themselves, to write what they thought. So what you were reading of various writers, and I think this is something unfortunately has disappeared from a lot of modern magazines, was pretty much their unmediated self. And it did strike me, I have to say, when I met people for the first time, Melody Maker's great writers like Chris Roberts, David Stubbs, Carol Clerk, the Stud Brothers, Steve Sutherland, Alan Jones, Matt Smith, etc., etc. Though I didn't understand very much about British accents and the difference between them, it did strike me that they all kind of sounded exactly as I imagined they probably would have from reading their copy, which I think tells you a lot about what good writers they were. I've always thought that's the sign of a good and indeed honest writer, if when you read them, you can hear their speaking voice in your head.
We started talking about the idea of this being a sort of bit of a last hurrah for the music press. What was it that kind of gave you that? Was it the monthly sales figures or the weekly sales figures kind of heading downwards? Or was it just the fact that there seemed to be too many bands that were like each other, and you kind of, if you didn't get an interview with one of the top four, you were kind of filling space? Did it feel like that?
Britpop, it was a perfect storm for the British music weeklies for all the obvious reasons. And then Britpop started to deflate, as these things invariably do. And nothing, at least nothing from our point of view, which was, you know, basically music with guitars, really arrived to replace it. There wasn't really anything else. And also at that point, late 90s, the awful truth of the internet is beginning to dawn on absolutely everybody. People are beginning to understand that it's no longer going to be necessary to pay for music, as long as you can square that with your conscience. It's no longer, there are other places where you can read about music that you don't have to pay for. The culture, again, as we were talking about earlier, the acceleration of the diffusion of the culture by the internet, there aren't those common reference points. The idea of there being this one big band like Oasis or Blur that everybody's got an opinion about starts to evaporate, and that I think was what accelerated the music press's decline, and also a lot of bad decisions made by the people who edited and published the music press, which is that they, rather than holding their nerve and their confidence, which is the only thing you can do in a crisis, they started chasing readers. And once you start doing that, you are absolutely doomed. They started to do that thing of basically destroying everything. Certainly in Melody Maker's case, they destroyed everything that was good about it in order to go chasing this new audience, which probably didn't exist, and obviously in the process completely alienated the one they already had.
And what's the song that we should play out on? What is the big one that leaps off these pages?
I feel like, given that we were just talking about Britpop, we should play something Britpop-ish. It is 20 years since Parklife this year. 20 years, Rob. 20 years since Parklife.
I know, and look, yeah, I know. These bags don't make themselves.
Exactly. Would that either of us had aged so well. We should play something off Parklife.
Which one?
I have a huge soft spot for End of a Century.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a lovely tune.
It's a lovely one. It really does sound like a Swan song.
It does. We all say the one to be alone. We wear the same clothes, can't we feel the same? And kiss the giants when we say goodnight. End of a century, oh, it's nothing special.
That was Andrew Muller, and his book, It's Too Late to Die Young Now, Misadventures in Rock and Roll, is out now and is just as waspishly charming as you'd imagine. After the break, we'll be hitting the documentary trail in Copenhagen.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Now in its 11th year, Copenhagen's documentary film festival, CPH Docs, began on the 6th of November and continues for 10 days in various venues throughout the Danish capital, with 200 films and numerous other events. Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth went along to the Film Huset in the city centre to find out more, first hearing from programme director Niklas Engström about what's new for the festival this year and how documentary filmmakers have become the new rock and roll stars. At least in Copenhagen.
When we started the festival 15 years ago, there was a very different atmosphere in the Danish documentary community, and I think in the general community of documentary filmmakers, where it was a very close community.
It was quite a nerd zone, wasn't it, documentary?
Yeah, it was. After CPH Docs came onto the scene, the parties, they changed in the film school. So suddenly it was the documentary film parties that were the crazy ones, the funny ones.
And also since, I guess, the days of Nick Broomfield, we've seen the documentary maker move in front of the camera and become the story, become the protagonist of their own films.
That is one trend. And another trend is the political documentary that actually want to change the world. And the third trend is the hybrid trend that we've been masters of, so to speak. We've really taken in a whole lot of different films that were on the verge of documentary and fiction. And that trend has been enormously popular for the last 5 years.
A good example of a filmmaker who's blurring the boundaries between documentary and drama is Anders Østergaard, an Oscar nominee a couple of years ago for Burma VJ. His new film, 1989, is actually opening CPH Docs this year.
We started the work on the border, barbed wire. Honecker smelt and felt the danger.
I'm taking an approach which some people feel is controversial about how to recreate these our protagonists of the story, which of course all the leaders of the time, Honegger, Gorbachev. I adapt archive images of themselves to reconstruct a dialogue.
You dub actors' voices? Yes. Over stock footage of Helmut Kohl or Gorbachev from the time, right?
That's it, yes, exactly.
And what I understand you do very well with this film is personalise the story of the fall of the wall through the story of one family and the last guy who was actually shot escaping from the Eastern Bloc.
Yes, that's the whole catalyst of what happened. The interesting thing is that the death of this person, this gentleman from East Germany, actually led directly to the Hungary opening its border to Austria, and then the rest is history.
Anders Østergaard's film has already generated an extraordinary amount of discussion in the Danish media. It was the front page headline story in this Sunday's Politiken, for example. Meanwhile, Mikkel Krogh's film, Ekstra Bladet, a fly-on-the-wall documentary about Denmark's most notorious tabloid newspaper, has also had a lot of coverage in the Danish media, as it comes at a time of tremendous upheaval, not just in the local newspaper industry here in Denmark, but in newspapers worldwide. Krogh gave me an insight into the lengths documentary makers go to secure access to their subjects. Although, it turns out, she did have one significant advantage in this case.
I use a lot of time. First of all, I just had a meeting saying I really want to make a documentary about a newspaper. Do you think that your newspaper would be a good idea? And they let me in just as an intern without a camera for 2 weeks. And then I went back and said, oh, I would love to come and film with a camera, just researching, nothing for public, just research. And I was there for 4 months, only doing research. So then after the 4 months, I was doing a pilot that I showed to them. And I said, that's kind of film that I want to make. And then they let me in for a year.
In a sense, documentary makers in the last few years have had the opposite graph from newspapers. Mm. You're on the up, you know. Documentaries are moving mainstream, becoming bigger business, bigger box office. Why?
I think because the documentary films are getting better, better. We are better storytellers. We are borrowing a lot from the fiction. Good photography, good editing, good music. So old days it was more like educational to see a documentary. Now it's more like entertainment.
I'm not sure you can classify the recent work of American documentary maker Joshua Oppenheimer as entertainment, but his last film, The Act of Killing, won a BAFTA and was nominated for an Oscar. His new film, The Look of Silence, is very much a companion piece to that film, returning to the subject of the mid-1960s Indonesian genocide. I asked him how it came about.
Tidak, saya menganggap itu tidak besar.
Bagaimana mungkin tidak besar? 1 juta orang dibunuh atau lebih.
We knew from the beginning that we were making two films. There's a scene in The Look of Silence, which is in fact the genesis of both films, where two men shot over a decade ago take me down to a riverside where they'd helped the army to kill 10,500 people. And they kind of gleefully show me how they went about it, taking turns playing victim and perpetrator, complaining that they hadn't thought to bring along weapons to use as props. And I knew there would be two films to make, one about what happens to a whole country, to our common humanity, when we build a whole political system on terror and lies, when killers win and build a whole system to justify their atrocities. I also knew there was an equally contemporary film to make, a film about today, as opposed to the events of 1965. That became The Look of Silence.
The Act of Killing was known for its incredible recreations using some of the original protagonists. It seems to be an ongoing theme in contemporary documentary making, and especially at this festival, about documentary makers fictionalizing, recreating. Do you have a problem with calling what you do documentary?
I often talk about what I do as nonfiction. I do that because I think to simply get away from the journalistic nuance of the word documentary, because I fundamentally think that nonfiction film is always about people playing themselves for the camera. We're told by fly-on-the-wall filmmakers that if you film someone for long enough, they forget that the camera's there. Well, unless you're filming a very small child or animals, no one ever confuses the state of being alone with the state of being observed by a camera crew, unaware of the camera.
Kalau kita kaji dulu begini, 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 kita ingin dulu. Wow, udah payah kan kejadian seperti dulu. Pasti akan kejadian.
So 1989, Extra Blell and The Look of Silence. These are some of the highlights of CPH docs. But also look out for Stranded in Canton, which looks at the mutual exploitation of Africa by China, and The Actress, starring Brandy Burr of The Wire, both of which use actors in stage scenarios, and I think point the way to the future of documentary making. For Monocle in Copenhagen, I'm Michael Booth.
Thank you, Michael. And coming up in the second half of the show, we'll discuss the pioneering women behind electronic music in the 1950s. There's a couple more tracks from Anne Midori House, Sessionistas, How to Dress Well. And as we remember the fall of the Berlin Wall, we take a look at East Berlin's wild days in the early 1990s, documented in a new photography book. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now back to How to Dress Well. There are Midori House session this week, and I'll speak to lead singer and songwriter Tom Krell right after this, Precious Love.
Don't run away, don't run away, don't run away, run away no more. Don't run away, don't run away, don't run away, run away no more. Say it now. But you know I can't hold back, baby. Hey, you're on and on and over again. This is the question you must ask yourself. But I see what I want and I see what I got, and I want it back. Whoa, whoa. What would it mean to relate, to relate, to relate, to relate, to relate? When all the frustration comes, frustration comes, frustration. On a weird adventure meant to me, so no, don't go. Just wait, just wait, just wait, just wait, just wait. Come on, be my precious love. Come on, be my precious love. Just say you wait, so wait, but when you wanna go, make it safe for me to stop. Be my precious. My precious love. Oh, oh. So don't run away, don't run away, don't run away, run away no more. Don't run away, don't run away, don't run away, run away no more. Don't run away, don't run away, don't run away, run away no more. Say that you wanted to relax. You say you wanna live this right. You say that I'm holding on too tight. But you say with regret that it goes too fast. Yeah. Say, baby girl, it goes too fast. Yeah. I see you pulling in for me. You wanna go, but baby, wait for me to say. And yeah. When the moment hits us, when the morning comes.
Getting songs out on tape, as it were, getting songs recorded it's a really strange and difficult process. It's kind of like painting a big painting, like little strokes here and there, and then eventually you step back, you see this 20-foot painting, and you know, you realize a few more strokes over here, and then the whole balance of the painting changes, and you're just constantly making these little interventions, you know. And I worked on these songs for so long that I became really obsessive. And then to have to produce another totally different translation of those for the live context, a translation that's a bit more live, so a bit more muscular, a bit fuller, but still manages to translate, to re-articulate the affects in the songs.
And do they become different things? I mean, I guess recording on your own, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of headphone action done, you know. I mean, you know, I think probably people are maybe familiar with the ways in which this sort of music, electronic music at its base, is recorded. Yeah. Especially
less,
with your vocals, which are kind
like,
of intimate as well. It's a very different experience, the live experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sing very differently on the record than I do live. On the record, it's very, very focused, very intimate. Live, it's, again, just to use this word because I think it captures something about the live performance, it's very muscular.
Yeah.
It's very bodily and full-bodied.
Wine tasting. That's what it sounds like.
No.
Wine tasting with Tom Krell.
It's more like the difference between, you know, reading a play and then seeing it staged.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Or when you see it staged and you see someone, say, for instance, murdered or lose a child or something, and you see someone act that out, it has a very different character than when you read the prose, which is so calculated and controlled.
And how precious can you be about these songs, which, you know, in the studio, when you say, you know, that it's like applying paint to a canvas and it needs a little attention top left, it needs this, it needs a little bit more detail here. It must be a strange experience when you have to take them out on the road and people know them from the record, people know different bits and bobs because of your SoundCloud playlist. It'd be nice to talk about those in a minute maybe. But is there a bit of nervousness about putting these children on the stage suddenly, these children of yours.
No, it's incredibly exciting.
Nice.
I'm kind of no less obsessive about putting together this live translation, you know. My bandmates, I can drive them a bit crazy because...
I'm not saying they're the children, the songs are your children.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I can, I care for these children songs, to run with this metaphor.
Yeah, God, please do.
Just as much on the stage as in the studio, and so I'm constantly... changing arrangements. You know, my violin player will wake up and I'll have changed the violin arrangement for two songs and he's, you know...
He'll be like, thanks.
Yeah, exactly. He's not happy. But, you know, if I hear something that it's less like hearing things that don't work and changing them. It's more like hearing an opportunity and then realizing, oh, if we could get, you know, like a little stacked violin part here, that would be extremely beautiful. And then trying it. And yeah, I mean, playing live is an extremely beautiful thing. It's a huge pleasure for me.
That was Tom Krell of How to Dress Well. They're touring around Europe for the rest of the year and further afield in 2015. Get Googling to find out more. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. Recognize that? I hope so. For those with an untrained ear, it's the original soundtrack to the BBC's long-running series Doctor Who, which is still one of the top-selling programmes around the world. It's also considered one of the great masterpieces of the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop, an experimental cavern set up by the broadcaster in 1958 to produce sounds for programmes which should not be made by traditional music or sound effects, sounds which are often as strange and compelling as the ones you can hear now. This track was composed by a woman named Delia Derbyshire in 1963, a hugely influential character in the Radiophonic Workshop's history. But what many people don't know is that the workshop was also founded by a woman, Daphne Oram, who also a gifted composer who turned down a place at the Royal College of Music to work for the BBC as a studio engineer and who went on to change the face of electronic music forever. It's a history which until recently has been relatively overlooked. So when we heard about an event taking place in London to celebrate Daphne Oram's legacy, there was no one else we could send to find out why and how we should tell her story than reporter, audiophile and former culture producer, Katie Bill Boer.
I'm Daphne Oram, the director of the studio, and I'd rather like to introduce you to some of the very varied sort of soundtracks which are produced at my studio.
This is a recording made by electronic music composer Daphne Oram in 1965 at her studio in Kent, just outside of London. She set the studio up after leaving the BBC's often mythologised Radiophonic Workshop less than a year after it was founded. We're listening to the soundtrack to an advert about power tools. Strange and captivating in its own right, but also one of many bread and butter projects which helped Aurum fund her work. Her true passion was her Auramix machine, a tool which enabled musicians to draw sounds on 35mm film and arrange them at the same time, the earliest predecessor to multi-track music editing software, and arguably the birthplace of modern electronic music.
Artists such as Daphne Aurum, it's only in the last 5-10 years that we've actually started understanding and appreciating her contribution to electronic music and actually inventing a lot of sound synthesis.
That's Shiva Fesharecki, an applauded experimental classical composer based in London.
I mean, we have composers such as Stockhausen, and they're very much mainstream culture, but Daphne Aurum at the time was very unknown. In fact, now when I talk to my composer friends, they know everything about composing and electronic music, but they do not know her still.
And that's why Shiva, alongside friend and events producer Gabriella Calalesina, decided to host an event to celebrate this rich history. As the rain pours down on a cold and wet November evening, a cafe cum arts venue tucked under a railway line in the East End of London is about to play host to an evening of experimental electronic music and discussion.
Okay, so what do we have here?
Well, it's a little circuit board that's probably about...
While the performers sound check, Shiva talks me through some of her homemade instruments sitting next to the mixing desk. Tiny 2x2-inch circuit boards with small wires poking out from them like minuscule electronic bonsai trees.
They're very simple, very, very simple, primitive objects. They both have light sensors, so then when you put them up against different types of lights, different coloured lights, they make a plethora of different sounds. It's actually quite unbelievable the different sounds that you can create from this tiny little simple circuit.
Tonight, Shiva will play these intriguing instruments with young composer Sophia Alexandra. It's Sophia's first ever performance. But before that, Shiva's taking to the stage with Ivor Novello award-winning composer Simon Fisher-Turner. Simon is a master of field recordings, what's now called found sounds, or as he puts it, life sounds. The idea of taking noises from everyday life and manipulating them using electronic technology is exactly what Daphne Aurum was doing generations before, something that came to be known as musique concrète.
So tonight is like making stuff out of the sounds. It's kind of a process which throws up lots of musical ideas which are generally unexpected.
While Simon crouches over a laptop, looping Swiss cowbells and crunching gravel, Shiva manipulates a record called Electronic Sound Patterns, a Daphne Aurum release which was designed to help teach children to dance. But while Aurum's work has been influential, Francis Morgan, deputy editor of magazine The Wire, who's speaking at tonight's event, says we should be careful about celebrating her as an enigmatic, lone pioneer. She thinks something which gets lost in the celebration of early female electronic artists are the struggles that many of them faced.
The idea that you're on your own, actually, I think is a slightly double-edged one. And I think a lot of women, including Daphne Aurum, did feel very isolated, did feel cut off. Delia Derbyshire, another radiophonic workshop female artist, you know, and technician, also was isolated and marginalised. And I think being marginalised, you know, is not something to celebrate at all, actually.
Francis says the idea of the lone genius isn't always accurate either.
What's increasingly becoming apparent over time is like an interest in not just the composer, the idea of the composer, but the technician, all those other people that contribute to the final product. And so when you think about that, the whole idea of who a piece of music belongs to and what a musical work is put into question.
So why do we seem to want to use this language when analysing music history?
I think the idea of the individual story is always very attractive. I mean, as a journalist, I know that. It's part of my day-to-day life, is to like find the story, find the person to speak to and kind of discover interesting figureheads, you know. When we learn history at school, we learn about leaders and we learn about generals and presidents and famous artists. I guess in a way it's easier to do that than to try and unpick the very complex strands of what makes up a musical scene. In a way, I suppose I'm being a bit provocative by trying to cut through the myth, but in a way I feel like it does Daphne Oram more of a service than a disservice. It's not about like idolizing somebody, it's more about understanding their place in history.
As I watch Shiva and young composer Sophia take to the stage with their homemade instruments, part in shadow, part illuminated by coloured lights, waving their arms back and forth like mad professors in a sound laboratory, I think, is this what the big moments in the radiophonic workshop or the Oramic studio were like? Brave and creative young women creating beguiling new soundscapes using low-budget technology. It may be problematic to label and celebrate these women as pioneers, past and present. But either way, I don't think there's any doubt that they, and the teams around them, have made an incredible contribution to the story of electronic music. For Monocle, in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
Thanks, Katie. How lovely to have you back on the show. After the break, we'll sit down with the people behind a new book that documents the wild years in East Berlin after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
This is Culture with me, Robert Band. The 9th of November marked 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Unified Germany is by most measures a success, a democracy with a strong economy that is able to view both its past and its progress with a critical eye. Some pockets, like once divided zone, now capital city Berlin, are still negotiating the uneasy integration of culture and commerce that followed the merging of East and West. After the border opened in 1989, many East Germans headed for the West. At the same time, numerous creative types, free spirits and opportunity seekers migrated in the other direction, making East Berlin their home, squatting abandoned buildings, producing experimental art, theatre and music, and just enjoying the relative chaos of a place forced to quickly redefine itself. Images from these untamed years are currently on display at Gestaltenspace in Berlin and in a book from photo agency Bob's Airport entitled Berlin Wonderland, Wild Years Revisited, 1990 to 1996. And these photographs are often astonishing. Piles of rubble, punks and freaks dancing among the ruins, the bohemian carnival of everyday life amidst the continuing existence of East Germans who stayed in their homes and neighbourhoods. The pictures from seven different photographers are interlaced with memories and anecdotes from witnesses to this peculiar history. Anke Fessel and Chris Keller of Bob's Airport edited and published the book, and they both came to live in East Berlin in 1990. And as they told Susan Stone, they were immediately taken by its gritty allure.
What we see is like the squatting of a new house. It's around the corner from Mainzer Straße, which later got famous by that violent eviction. What we see is a kind of a surreal, peaceful scenario, like some people from the gay community from Mainzer Straße working around in kaftans, naked children playing, others are working, trying to clean up the house. And the whole picture like is a picture of coolness somehow, but a relaxed coolness.
And there's just this piles and piles of dirt. And this is one thing that characterizes a lot of the photos in the book is ruins and rubble. It looks like a bomb hit in 1945 and nobody ever cleaned it up.
I think that pretty much describes the situation. It is like this because the East German government somehow concentrated on building new large blocks out on the outskirts of town, and they neglected the old buildings in the middle of the city because they had plans to build it new anyway. So they leave lots of the houses empty or with a few people in, and that was the chance for the squatters. But these houses had been sometimes been out of use for years, and there was a lot of dirt to clean, to repair, get basic infrastructure going like electricity, water. It was dirty and it was rubble.
And so creative people from outside Berlin, so from West Berlin, from West Germany, from Europe, from the States, wherever, they all come to this ghost town. And what happens?
I think you need to say that it was not a ghost town in the sense that the people from East Berlin were there. And that's very important because, I mean, we really mixed in these houses. So like in all of the projects I've lived in or worked with, there were people like from all over the world. But, and that's really important, there were a lot of people from East Germany and from East Berlin.
It was a melting pot somehow, and it's exactly what Anke was saying would have been my first point, that it was sometimes much nicer to live together with these East German people because somehow they had learned a huge lesson in solidarity, because being sort of as punks or artists repressed by the East German government, they somehow had a very nice way with each other, and it was good to be together with them in the projects, meeting them.
So let's go a few pages ahead, and there's that great picture of Tacolus with the planes in front of it.
Okay. Here we go.
So we have to sort of describe for people that the Tacolus was known as a very important spot for the arts.
Tacolus is a good symbol for how cultural projects not work out to their best, because some people started to commercialize parts of it and start to fight the other parts which didn't like the commercialization. Got sometimes pretty much violent even in the art house, bloody noses. The picture, coming back to the picture, what you see, I think it's 93, you see a MiG-21 fighter jet being raised in a like 45 degree angle, like it lifts off from the ruin. It's covered in light and looks kind of amazing, crazy thing. And the Mutoid Waste Company, it's a trash artist group who sort of make anti-militaristic installations by stealing military equipment and bringing it into other means. And this is part of a show they made together with Spiral Tribe. I think they made a huge festival, which was very crazy, even for that time.
We do see from maybe more of the relaxed scenes, you have the feeling that everyday life here was performance art.
I think a lot of the daily life really took place in the streets, and that's maybe what you can also get from the pictures. So, and of course there were a lot of artists, a lot of especially performance artists, and I think at that time we had performance art was really big here in Berlin. So there were a lot of groups and there were a lot of artists performing, rehearsing in the streets, and so, and yeah, it was really lively then.
That was Anke Faisal and Chris Keller speaking to Susan Stone. The exhibit at the Gestalten Space continues until November the 22nd, and the book Berlin Wonderland is out now, published by Gestalten. Next week, we'll be discussing Arab sci-fi literature, and there's music from the Malian band Songhoi Blues. You've been tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and my producer was Holly Fisher. I don't think she was quite usurped by Katie Bulbers. Nonetheless, fascinating discussion on female radiophonic workshopists. Time for one final song this week from How to Dress Well. This is Suicide Dream. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Said I was sleeping in the back of a car that we took, And I was wondering how I could see my own face. Yeah, it said in the world on the side, I'm on my way back. And I was sleeping in the back of a car that we took. Yeah, that we took. And now I'm just missing you. Said I was wondering, how can the world we know won't be lost? Yeah. I said how it was left to go the road. And I mean, my God, why are we both so alone? Lost in my little soul, such a dream. Think about you daily, yeah. I talk to your sister, that girl is crazy, she's crazy, and man, I can't believe you had a some shit that life goes on, that life goes on, that life goes on, goes on. Oh,